Chapter 15, It's Greek to Me by Willie Snow Etheridge. 15. The lights go on and on in Distamon. Every evening at sundown in the village of Distamon, the women and children gather in the cemetery beneath the black cypresses and light candles above the graves of their dead. They have done it daily for 3 years now, in rain, sleet, snow, and fading sun, and they show no sign of growing weary of it. Only Eleni Angelopoulou is impatient at the custom, always arguing that the dead should be with the dead and the living with the living. She wants the people of Distamon to put their tragedy behind them and go forward on into a new day. But the heart seems to have gone out of them, and they move through the days like shadows waiting for the twilight hour. Eleni and I waited with them that one evening after driving from Athens in the jeep with Costa for that purpose. We had set out early, for we knew the roads would be practically impassable, and that we would be held up frequently by Greek soldiers. Distamon is only a few miles off the main highway to Delphi, and the highway is heavily guarded to prevent, as far as possible, the smuggling of recruits and arms to the guerrillas in the mountain section. The trip was uneventful until we left the now crooked streets of Thebes and came out into the wide valley, and then the evening was only a black cloud. But it was the first cloud I had seen since coming to Greece. I had begun to believe that clear golden sunshine was cupped permanently beneath the blue Greek sky. The cloud rolled like carbon paper out of the encircling hills, and slowly big drops of rain began to fall. "It is intaxiae," said Eleni. "We always suffer for rain in Greece." For a little, while the men and women in the flat fields continued to plow, but as the rain quickened to flapping sheets, they unhitched the plows and strapped them to the sides of the oxen and horses and plodded towards their villages. They were preparing the land for cotton, Eleni told me. This wide valley near Thebes is the rich cotton-growing section of Greece. I could see piles of brown stalks that had been pulled up by the roots and gathered together to be hauled off, no doubt, for firewood. Near Distamon, we ran out of the rain and out of the plain. Distamon huddles in the flat palm of a small hand of land and with mountainous fingers turned up around it. The unpaved roads were deep in mud, but women were trudging through it unconcernedly, carrying on their backs the bundles of brushwood. It is for the oxen to bake the bread. It is for the oven to bake the bread, Eleni commented. In all the villages, the women prepare the bread themselves. They have a village oven into which that brush fits perfectly. But there weren't many women on the roads, and curiously enough, no men. I looked at Eleni questioningly, remembering with a sinking heart, Calavrita. Yes, there are men here, she answered, but they are out tending the sheep and working in the fields. By coincidence, in Distamon, women and children and even babies were killed as casually as men. Then Eleni recounted what she called the drama of Distamon. I tried to get her to tell it all the way from Athens, but like a timid woman refusing to open a telegram in which she fears there is bad news, Eleni kept putting it off. My God, she cried once, I must forget it if I'm not going to the crazy house. But how can I forget if I have to talk about it? And now, bumping and slithering along the muddy street, she began. Distamon was not active in guerrilla business. Perhaps there were four or five guerrillas from here, but most of the people live patiently, waiting for the liberation. And so they lived until June 10, 1944. On that day, the Germans came here and made inspection. They stayed over 2 hours and nothing was wrong. They left to go to another village to make another inspection, and the people were happy, if I can use that word. She looked at me with her big black eyes, but I said nothing. Well, by coincidence, there were guerrillas up a mountain on the way to the next village, and they started to shout against the Germans, to shoot against the Germans. They shoot some Germans down, and they wounded a German colonel. The Germans thought, of course, that the people of Distamon had sent word to the guerrillas, but they had only made the cross that they were set, that they were free. It was 5 o'clock, no doubt about 5:30 in the afternoon, when the Germans came back to the town and shooted whom they found before them. They went into every house and killed 280 people. They shoot animals, a dog, a cat, a sheep, on the way. Costa stopped the jeep by the side of the gate of a rather pretentious two-story house. "Here we get out," Eleni announced. "The Near East Foundation now has this house for a feeding station, but before the tragedy, it was the home of one of the, how you say it, well-to-do men of the town. By coincidence, he was ill in bed when the Germans opened the door and shooted him. Standing near him was his wife, a very young woman with a baby 8 months old in her hand. The Germans shooted her and the baby, too, but their little girl escaped. She was standing behind the door, and the Germans did not see her. She is now a child of the Near East Foundation." Eleni led me up a flight of stairs on the outside of the house to a square living room on the second floor. A few sticks of wood were burning in a large cement fireplace and a vase of plum blossom bright in the side table. The matron and nurse of the home came in and welcomed us. They hurried out to make coffee. "Go on," I said to Elena, "about the massacre." "My God, have you not heard enough?" "No, I want to hear everything." "Well, happily, it started to be dark and the Germans were afraid in a strange town and left. Some families were not touched. They were with the sheep or in the fields, but even the families who never lost anybody mourned." Eleni moved around the room restlessly, straightening first the new cretonne curtains at the windows, then restacking some account books on the table. "The peasants here despise the guerrillas," she declared, coming to rest against the mantel. "If you say only the name guerrilla, they kill you. But when the guerrillas attacked the Germans, they were only doing their duty as I saw it," I argued, trying to comprehend this hatred that many Greeks seem to have had for the guerrillas even during the years of resistance. "My God," Eleni flared, "if the guerrillas could protect the village, that would be all right. But they know when they kill Germans, the Germans would come back and murder the villagers. That's what we can't forgive. They are beasts." She paced the floor in front of the fireplace. "The truth is, the guerrillas warned Distamon to be massacred because it was not a communist village. Why, even after this drama, the guerrillas came into town and took 12 men into the mountains. 4 months, no one heard about them. Then their bodies were found, killed. There was a storekeeper here now who lost 4 brothers, grown-up men with families. You can find him here, and he can speak to you. But I did not find him and let him speak me, and he can speak you. But I did not find him and let him speak me. Instead, I listened to the story of the nurse when she and the matron brought in the coffee and joined Eleni and me around the big center table. There were tears in her eyes, for the next day was her nephew's 21st birthday, and she did not know whether he was in this life. "You mean you don't know whether he is living?" My voice was high with amazement. "No," she shook her head slowly. "He was kidnapped by the communists when he was 18 years and 5 months old, and we have not heard from him since. I was living in Athens in the summer of 44, and my nephew came here to visit me from Salonika, his home. He had had his visit and was ready to return to Salonika when, on the last afternoon, August 13th, he and 4 other boys and 2 girls went out to swim and never came back." "None of them?" "None of them. the police say they saw a band of communists take them away. Why didn't the police stop them? She looked at me pityingly. The police were helpless. There were too many communists. She put her untouched cup of coffee back on the tray. From that time on, I am like an old lady. I'm mourning. My hair has turned white. Have you heard any word of him? Yes, once a woman sent a letter from Athens to my sister in Salonika that he is living, but we do not know. She was a stranger. She would not sign her name. She brushed tears on her cheeks with a twisted paper napkin in her hand. I and the mother of one of the other boys went into the mountains where the communists were. We were like foolish, we were. We went to that mountain, this mountain, that mountain. She shook her head in a dazed, bewildered fashion. We could learn nothing. I'm afraid. A wisp of a girl in dull black crept into the room and laid a piece of wood on the fire. That's a very good maid, the nurse whispered as the girl went out, but sometimes she's nervous. I do not mind, though, for I understand why she is nervous. She saw all the members of her family killed. She alone escaped. I would ask her to tell you, but whenever she talks, she begins to cry. Eleni shut the account book she had been checking and announced, "We will now see after children." Walking down the wide hall to a front room, Eleni said with a deep sigh, "These are the dramas we have suffered. By coincidence, you have heard." In the front room, about 30 young girls, shrouded as somberly as crows, sat at long tables playing parcheesi and dominoes and doing many types of fancy work. They, of course, have no games at home, Eleni explained, so they come here in the afternoon to have a good time. At home, they are not allowed to play, nor talk loud, nor sing, nor do anything gay. One child in a black scarf, black coat, black stockings, and black shoes looked no older than my Mr. Big, but her looks must be deceiving, I thought. How old is she? I asked Eleni. She is now 8, and in deep mourning? Yes, her mother and father were shot in the massacre, and for 3 years now she has worn mourning. They would like to give her a bright frock, but her grandmother will not let her wear it. We leave the house at sunset and see women and children with small copper pitchers of oil hurrying along the narrow winding road to the cemetery. They look neither to the right nor to the left. They could be judges of the Supreme Court in their robes of black, filing to their places behind the bench. They are that solemn. Now and then, other women come out of doorways or from side streets and unnoticing swell the ragged procession. Eleni and I, solemn too, stride along with them. The sun has now gone down, and the sky in the west is slip-colored in soft mauve satin. I glimpse it in rectangles between the slim, sky-sweeping cypresses on the rim of the hill where the graves are spread. A shepherd with his flock of sheep, returning from the mountains to his home in the village for the night, catches up with the latecomers. Quickly, the air is steeped with the sad, sweet music swinging from the bells at the ram's throats. The maid from the Near East Foundation walks in the road ahead of us, her head wrapped in thick plates and her shoulders beneath a heavy shawl, black, of course, are bowed. Poor girl, says Eleni. 10 were killed in her house, and now her heart doesn't work good. We reach the top of the hill and turn into the gate of the cemetery. Solitary figures in black stand by. Ornate crosses over the slope. There are no speeches, no prayers, no tolling bells. The mourners move noiselessly to the crosses above their dead and stop there, clutching their copper containers of oil. There is nothing dramatic about it. It is too unstaged, too heartbreakingly simple. I follow a 14-year-old girl with the face of a Madonna and kneel beside her at the head of her father's grave while she lights a piece of twisted cotton stuck on a cork that floats upon the oil she pours into a small urn. Her big eyes are dry, but dark and sad as pools shaded from the sun. Slowly, shaking my head to express my sympathy as best I know how, I get up and tiptoe away. I want to leave the cemetery. I have seen enough. But near the gate, an old woman, her back bent to a right angle, puts out her hand and stops me. There are 6 graves at her feet, a father, a mother, and 4 children, ages 6, 5, 4, and 1. They are the graves of her daughter, son-in-law, and grandchildren. She wants to tell me about them, but she chokes and tears rush down her cheeks. "Now," she cries, says Eleni, turning her heart to stone. Everybody cries. Everybody has his own story. Greece needs years that the morale can go again. She tugs at my sleeve and leads me towards the gate. "Let us go," she urges, "so we too do not cry." My God, I do not wish that anybody in this life will see what Greece has seen. I do not wish it even to my enemies. Holding to her, I stumble down the hill, leaving behind those lights so faithfully lit, and yet so flickering and feeble and ineffectual against the Greek night. End of chapter 15.